Our first case for this morning will be Todd v. Penn, 1138-18. Mr. Todd.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Michael Todd. I'm the appellant in this case. The issues on appeal is whether the district court erred in finding an assignment of claims by Fletcher to me and my prosecution of those claims violates Illinois public policy as being close enough to Champerty or Baratree, also whether or not it violates Illinois public policy relating to the unauthorized practice of law, and finally, whether the district judge erred in not allowing me to amend my complaint. My sixth grade teacher, Mrs. Halverson, used to tell us that close only counts in horseshoes, hand grenades, and slow dancing. I think it's difficult enough for litigants to anticipate and predict future rulings when a court limits itself to simple statements of what the law does and does not allow. But it becomes nearly impossible in a case like this, through the use of horseshoe jurisprudence, to allow a new standard of close enough to count as a reason to dismiss the case as being void as against public policy.
But what I will point out to you, Mr. Todd, is first of all, we review judgments, not individual words and opinions. And secondly, for this kind of dismissal, our review is de novo. And what I can't figure out is if your system is okay, if somebody can just say, assign me all of your claims and I will then pursue them, what's left of unauthorized practice of law? It seems to me the Illinois courts have been very clear that you can't do an end run around these restrictions, and whatever you may think of them, they are the law of Illinois, and they've been put in place for consumer protection.
Thank you. Yes, I believe the distinction there and what makes my case distinguishable between all the other cases cited in Franklin's brief and by the court is that those cases were, in fact, cases where non-attorneys were actually attempting to represent either a corporation or an individual on claims that still belong to that corporation or that individual.
But, you know, isn't that a formality? I mean, I guess your point is, you know, Ms. Fletcher just sold her claim to you outright for whatever amount was settled on between you. But that's just an upfront way of letting you act as a lawyer.
I would respectfully disagree.
Well, you can, of course, but you lose.
Pardon me?
I say you can disagree, all right, but you lose.
Oh, yeah, that's understandable. I believe that the assignment, if you look at the assignment, it's not a naked right to litigate. The assignment is a full and complete assignment of all interest in the claims. Because of that, those claims then become my property. And due to the fact that the claims are then my property, it's well established that a party has a right to proceed pro se.
Could a disbarred lawyer do the same thing you did?
I would say if a disbarred lawyer is the actual owner and the real party in interest on a claim, then absolutely.
You misunderstood my question. Could a disbarred lawyer do what you did?
I would say so.
So your answer is yes?
Yes. I don't see.
What's the purpose then of disbarring a lawyer if he can just go out and buy a claim?
Well, the purpose would be if he's representing a client who is still the owner of their actual claims.
Could he do what you did, and your answer was yes, and I want to know then what is left to disbarring a lawyer? What purpose would there be to disbar him if he could go proceed to buy somebody's claim and then sue on his own behalf?
Well, I would argue that, yes, he probably could, provided that the claim was assignable. Here what we have to look at is
Could a tort be assignable? For instance, could I assign to you my right to sue because I was in an automobile accident with somebody else's fault and I got my leg broken?
No, absolutely not.
Why not?
Because that goes to pain and suffering, for instance. There's a distinct difference.
You dented my car. He dented my car. I want my car returned. Is that all right?
Now well, if it's an economic damage,
yeah.
Clearly under the law, economic damages are assignable. You know, I think that
all economic damages are assignable for purposes of filing lawsuits.
Well, for purposes of either attempting to settle a claim prior to filing a lawsuit, or if need be, to commence litigation. You know, I think it's there's a lot of similarities between, for instance, nowadays you see tens of thousands of cases that are brought by debt buyers.
But they're not brought pro se. I think you jump from the fact that something might be assignable to the separate question whether a lawyer has to pursue that claim on behalf of the assignee. And Illinois seems to say you can't assign legal claims in order to practice law without a license. You can hold as many claims as you want. If you had hired a lawyer to pursue Ms. Fletcher's claim for you, that might be a very different case that we don't have before us.
Right, but in the finding of the court, what the court actually found was that through some type of subterfuge, I was attempting to litigate the claims of others. I think what this court is missing in the distinction is there was no allegations of any type of fraud or deceit to bring the claim before the court. Which is essentially subterfuge. The claim.
Well, let me put your mind to rest. I think you were very open with what you were doing, and I think that you are relying on the distinction between somebody who holds back part of an interest in a claim and an outright purchase of a claim. I'm just not convinced that that's what Illinois law does.
Correct. Your Honor, I can say this, that I have researched. I have found absolutely no cases. Neither has the appealee presented any cases in its brief, nor the lower court could even find a case to hang its hat on that says an assignee cannot proceed pro se. So I think that this case is actually a case of first impression before this court, and it, like I said before, any of the cases relied on by the court or I. Franklin is certainly distinguishable in this case.
Okay. Do you want to save some time for rebuttal?
I will save some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Penn?
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Justin Penn, and I represent Franklin Collection Service. The appellee in this case. The district court dismissed the lawsuit on two alternative bases, one of which hasn't been talked about yet, and that's that the plaintiff failed to allege facts on which he could have stated a claim. That was the second alternative basis. The claims that were brought in the case were two negligence claims, one gross, one regular negligence, and then a claim under 1692E of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. While we were briefing the motion to dismiss, this court decided the Purcell case. And the Purcell case clarified what was the understanding, which is that the FCRA preempts not only regular negligence claims, but gross negligence claims. There was a little bit of a misunderstanding under the FCRA because of two different subsections on preemption. And Purcell clarified that all negligence claims, all state tort claims, and all state statutory claims are preempted by the FCRA. So there is no way that there could have been a state court claim, a state tort claim, or a state statutory claim under the anything that is covered under the provision of 1681S2A. That Purcell cleared up for us. We also understand there's no private right of action under 1681S2A, so there is no FCRA claim. So that leaves us really with what could be pled under 1692E of the FDCPA. 1692E is the provision of the FDCPA which prohibits false, deceptive, and misleading statements or representations in the efforts to collect the debt. There are 16 subsections that detail exactly certain areas that you can't, certain things that are prohibited. One of them is 16E8. That's the only one that even remotely touches upon anything with respect to credit reporting or furnishing of credit information, and that says that you can't communicate or threaten to communicate to any person credit information that is false, and that includes failing to communicate that the dispute of a debt or that a disputed debt is disputed. Under E8, the FTC staff commentary provides a distinction between when a debt collector learns of a debt or learns of a dispute on a debt, and it clarifies that if a debt collector learns of a dispute before it furnishes information to the credit bureau, then it has to report the information, report the debt as disputed. That makes sense because it would be a violation under E, clearly, if you knew of a dispute and you didn't tell the bureau of that dispute. But it goes on to say if a debt collector learns of a dispute afterwards, it doesn't have any obligation to go back to the bureau and clarify that this debt is disputed. That also makes sense because under the framework of the FCRA, and in particular under Section 18 or 1681 S2, it breaks down that under S2A, those are the duties of a furnisher, which is what Franklin is in this case. A furnisher has to provide correct information to the best of its ability. Once it does that, it then doesn't have any more obligations to anyone until it receives a dispute under S2B. When it receives a dispute, then it has an obligation to go in and investigate the dispute. But that's the only section under which there's a private cause of action against a furnisher. Again, that makes sense under the framework of the FCRA because credit furnishers really have a very limited ability to control what ends up on a credit report. All they can do is furnish information that they believe or know to be accurate, and then the bureaus decide whether or not it ends up on a report. And I'll give just a brief example of this. My brother and my father both share the same name. They obviously share many of the same former addresses. If you got my brother's credit report, I'm sure there's a load of stuff on there about my dad. I know that to be true. The furnishers of information have not furnished incorrect information. They've furnished information about my dad, but they have the same name, and they have the same former addresses. So if you hit one of their credit reports, the bureaus are going to put it on there. So it makes sense in that situation. You wouldn't hold a furnisher liable just because they furnished correct information and it ended up on a report until you've said, hey, this is not me, this is my dad. And then they go in and they find out and they do a reasonable investigation and they get it off my brother's credit report. Well, in this case, the plaintiff pled there were no communications. There were no communications with the bureaus. FCS, by its own admission, rightly or wrongly, the plaintiff has said, in this case, FCS didn't communicate beyond furnishing the information that they furnished at the outset. There's no claim for furnishing information that is wrong if you don't know it to be wrong, and there's no allegation here as to how FCS could have known it was wrong. And there's no claim of further communication, so there can't be a claim under E. We've referenced the Wilhelm case, which is an Eighth Circuit case. That adopts the FTC commentary, and that's sound reasoning. Now, with respect to the assignment being void against public policy, the Illinois Supreme Court has explained that the primary consideration in assessing whether a cause of action can be assigned is whether it violates public policy. So that's the focus, is whether or not this violates public policy. The court's conclusion was based upon three things: the assignment itself, the three other district court cases that Mr. Todd has filed, and his website. Now, this court has explained, clearly these are things and matters that are outside the pleading. Well, the assignment's not, because the assignment's alleged to be the basis for the pleading. So attaching the assignment is part of the pleading. With respect to the other lawsuits, we know under GE Capital versus lease resolution that this court has said it's permissible to take judicial notice of matters that are in the public without converting a 12B6 motion into a summary judgment motion.
That's the other lawsuits. What about this website, though? Doesn't he say he took it down?
Well, Judge, I don't know. I do believe he's taken it down, but it was still a matter of public record. And the public record cases...
A lot
cases,
of things are a matter of public record. That might not be enough for 12B6.
Well, Judge, the distinction that is drawn by this court is whether or not the facts that are contained in the public record are capable of a reasonable dispute. And in this case, this is not a situation where I attached an affidavit that he disputed from my client, that he didn't have access to my client. This is his website. This is his record. This is not my record. So it's really not capable of reasonable dispute, or if it was capable of reasonable dispute, he didn't dispute it. I mean, there's no, but beyond that, we don't need to get to the website to get to the conclusion that the court drew.
That's a better way to approach
it. Yeah, there's no question that the court's ruling in this case is that based upon the record that was in the record that was created. So forget the website, just look at the existence of other cases and the assignment itself. That's enough to conclude that Mr. Todd may be engaged in the unauthorized practice of law or engaged in a subterfuge to facilitate the prosecution of others' claims. That's what's happening. There's no question that that's what's happening. By his own admission, that's what's happening.
Isn't there an economic disincentive to do what Mr. Todd is doing, it seems, is he's going on, he's buying people's claims, just the way, you know, some credit consolidation agencies buy up claims from companies, and he's now going forward and seeing what he can get for the claims. And when you put it that way, you know, he's only going to invest as much as he thinks the claims are worth, whereas a lawyer is going to, you know, share the risk with the client.
I'm not sure I understand the question, but if your question is if there's an economic disincentive to the plaintiff?
No, to people in the position of Mr. Todd. I mean, they have to invest in buying all of these claims, and so there's some natural limit to how many they're going to buy, I would presume.
I would presume I guess it depends on the individual.
It depends on his resources.
Yeah, right.
But why is what he's doing different from what, you know, companies that buy up bad debts?
Oh, well, in at least three ways. The first is that in this case, the assignment is very narrow. The assignment is purely just the legal claim. This is not a situation where we've got a contract where the assignee is stepping into the shoes of the assignor such that the other party has all the terms of the contract, the arbitration clause, everything available, the defenses to the claim. I mean, granted, we would have the defenses to the actual claim here, but, you know, we couldn't collect the debt. We couldn't collect Ms. Fletcher's debt from the plaintiff. We couldn't collect. We couldn't report this on Mr. Todd's credit report. The second way is that these damages. I don't believe that these damages are economic damages. I don't want to concede that. I mean, we talk a little bit about that. I don't know that it matters. In Illinois, when damages are personal, they're not assignable. The damages here are statutory damages, where Congress said we can't quantify your damages if something like this happens. If you don't have actual damages, so you get statutory damages. That's a personal damage. Second is damage to a credit score. If that's even a damage, that's definitely a personal damage. And the third is this idea of emotional distress or any sort of injury to reputation. That's definitely a personal damage. But the last and most significant is, as Your Honor pointed out, these debt buyers in that situation go out and hire licensed debt collectors or licensed attorneys to collect it lawfully on their behalf. So they still play within the framework of Illinois law, and as they're required to do. So those are three important distinctions as to how it would be different. Okay. With that, I'll conclude my remarks unless there are any other questions.
Apparently not. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Todd?
I believe, once again, the distinction in this case, although Mr. Penn is somehow alleging that I'm seeking to recover damages outside of economic damages. As alleged in the complaint, Ms. Fletcher incurred economic damages based on monies that she had to pay to a company.
Let me intrude myself. Is there anything in the record that shows that you paid the lady to get her, acquire her claim?
The actual assignment was redacted.
My question was, is there anything in the record that indicates that you paid for what you got?
There's nothing in the record that states whether or not I paid for what I got. There is in the record that I gave Ms. Fletcher some type of consideration. However, the problem was the court just made this conclusion that I somehow provided some type of service or consultation, and that was part of the reason that they were...
But the record does not disclose that you paid for it.
The record does not disclose what I paid or if I provided some other type of product.
Or if you paid it all.
Or if I paid it all. No, the record doesn't disclose that. But it would seem logical that a person wouldn't simply give away a claim for free if the court would have at least allowed
the question is whether you promise us something in the future that I will pay you if I collect. Or
no, absolutely not. No. There was no agreement between Fletcher and myself to divide any of the proceeds in the event of any settlement or successful litigation, which I think sets this case apart. Being that I'm not sharing in the proceeds, that also goes towards the issue of being too close to Champerty as well. But with that, I will conclude my argument. I thank the court for its time.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.